Hello and welcome to That Thing I Did for a Year, a podcast where we talk to fourth-year University of Toronto students about experiences they had in a year away from school. My name is Ilya. I'm a fourth-year industrial engineering student here at the University of Toronto, and I'll be talking to Romy. Behind production is Arkadiy Hungarovsky, a fourth-year engineering science student and the mastermind behind the operation. So today we'll be talking to Romy. Why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Romy Doan. I am a Min 1T7 plus two PEYs.
And where did you do your PEY?
I did my PEY. I actually started a little bit in oil sands, and then I had an opportunity come up, and I went up north to the Arctic, so close to the Arctic Circle, to a diamond mine that was on an island in the middle of a large lake, and I spent 2 years there.
That sounds like a fairy tale and not like a PEY, yeah. But I'm sure we're going to get to that. So before you even came into university, what made you decide on mineral engineering?
Back in grade 11, I took a trip to Saskatchewan, of all places, Saskatoon, and then it was like a science and technology trip through the Rotary International Club, and we toured a whole bunch of little different like science facilities and labs and things like that, and there was a diamond lab, of all places, and I fell in love with like all the work that they were doing, the way they were, they had their grease tables, because that's how you like pick up your diamonds, and how they were characterizing them, and just this the cool aura about the place, and so I thought, all right, that sounds pretty cool. And then I heard a talk from a field geologist. He gave a talk to the whole audience. And he was talking about how he used to just climb to a helicopter and then they'd fly him into the middle of nowhere and literally push him out and then just leave him there for like weeks. And he would just hike around, have a great time, log some stuff, look at some things, collect data, and then like come back and then make a whole like boatload of money from this.
Like, and I was 007, like, but a geologist.
Honestly. And I was like, oh, that sounds what I want to do. And so I looked into all the things I could do, because he was also like an engineer. He was an engineer turned geologist. And then I was like, that sounds like that's for me. And so that's how I started.
I mean, that's a fantastic sell.
Yeah, right?
That is some Alex Rider type, like, mm-hmm. kid spy stuff. Okay, so you know, you're looking at the university programs and you're like, boom, mineral engineering. Was that mm-hmm. something that was like after Googling, or did somebody say, hey, if you want to do rocks, do mineral engineering?
I knew I had to do some sort of like geological mining sort of thing from the internet. And then I was looking around at the universities, and then, so I'm from like this really tiny town out west on Vancouver Island, like not even a main city. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I need to get out of here. And then I knew about the University of Toronto, and they said they were like the best in engineering, the best at everything, which is true. Like if you look at their statistics, they're like pretty good. And so I thought, I want to have the best. And then I wound up here in their mineral program.
Nice. What was the move like from small town on Vancouver Island to Toronto?
It was different. The weirdest thing that I found was that when I came to Toronto, I saw a whole bunch of people walking down the street, and I thought they all looked like people from home. And so I was like, Bill! And then I was like, no, Romy, like, stop saying things. This is not like your 2,000 person town. Like, it's not Bill.
So like you knew everybody.
Yeah, you pretty much knew everybody. Okay. And then, I came to Toronto, and like, no one had any of the small town, like, hey, how you doing? No one talks to each other at the grocery store. You don't like hold elevators for each other. Well, who am I kidding? We didn't have buildings tall enough for elevators. But like, if there was, like, I don't know, it's just
I'm sure
different.
They would be held.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay. And so moving into like new college residence here was like a whole big change. It was exciting. I had my own room. I liked it.
That was new.
Well, I mean, like, I have my own room, my parents' house, of course, but like to be away and like feeling like an adult, but of course you're 18, you're not an adult at all. Uh-huh. As you find out later in life, but it feels big at the time.
Like responsibilities and yeah. whatnot. Yeah. What was first year like?
First year was wild. So I lived on like an engineering floor at New College, and then I made some really good friends. We still talk. And first year was hard though, because it was a huge transition, because I think everybody is the big dog at their school. They're like the smartest kid, and everyone's like, wow, I want to be that person. Then you go to university thinking you're the best, and then you come here and you're like, wow, I'm so mediocre. Like, very few people find out that they're still the best.
Right, we're mediocre on average.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, I was definitely one of the mediocre kids, and yeah. I was like, that's fair. Like, that's fair. I'm fine with that.
How did you get yourself to be fine with that? Because I know a lot of people, it took them like a while to get over.
I definitely had some struggles in the beginning, but I got over it pretty quick. So I was like, you know, this doesn't like take away from me at all being mediocre. It just means that there's other people who are also really good at this and sometimes better. And I can respect that, because mm-hmm. those people are the ones who are like curing cancer. And I know I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something different. Mm-hmm. But like, I just thought it was cool that they're that smart and they're doing that. And I thought, this doesn't actually affect me in any way to be upset about it. And I can just do my best. Which sounds really adult, but like it took weeks to get into that.
Okay, first of all, weeks is pretty good, because some people take decades or never.
Yes.
And second of all, it sounds decently adult for 18. Were you thinking about any type of career stuff during first year, like going into first year summer?
I just wanted a job in mining, which I didn't get because it's almost impossible to get a job in mining after first year. I also didn't really know what mining was in first year, and I think that's the case with a lot of first years and even second years. Like, we just have no idea because the industry is so niche and it's so away from downtown Toronto, obviously.
Sure.
That we don't really hear a whole lot about it. And what you do hear is like all the Bay Street investors, which is super cool, but there's a whole lot of other things going on in mining. And as like a first year, you just try and like eat up all the information you can and apply to whatever jobs you can and see what happens. So I didn't really know what was going to go on after first year. After first year, I actually went on exchange to China through the U of T.
Like for the summer?
Yeah, for aerospace engineering, which I thought was hilarious because I don't know anything about circuits. And then I was there trying to... It didn't go very well. And it was also like half in Chinese, half English. And I was struggling.
It sounds like there were a few barriers.
There's just a couple.
Were you there for the whole summer?
No, I was only there for like over a month. U of T sent two people. It was like an international school.
Sure.
And it was half international, half like the locals from that that university. And it was a really good experience, but after a while I realized, you know what, I'm probably not going to be a systems engineer. And so I just like enjoyed the rest of my time and like went out, went for walks, like stopped studying so much because I was like, this isn't going to work for me. And I ended up passing everything. It was all good. But yeah, it was an eye-opener into a whole other like discipline.
Okay. So did second year feel different from first? Did you like feel like now you know what mining is, or like when did that happen?
I didn't know a whole lot more about mining. I knew that engineering got a whole lot harder in second year, and I was like, whoa, this took a 90-degree turn. But did I know much more about mining? We have like some more mining-related courses. I feel like a lot of other disciplines might start a little bit earlier because you're doing like, you know, like dynamics, mechanical stuff, and things move, or like fluid mechanics, and mining, like you're not really getting a... Like, here's how you dig dirt. Like, there's a little bit of that. And then it's not really until third year which you really get that information. So for the first 2 years, it's still super general. And you don't know a whole lot about mining.
What kind of general information is there that is still, like, applicable to mineral engineering? I'm just trying to place this because I know for most people, like, first year, you have, like, the one course that is kind of like your course.
Yeah.
And then second year, you have a whole lot more. Like, oh, this is what I do. Like, why do you guys do general stuff?
So the first thing I just want to mention is in first year, the civs and mins take kind of a rock looking course, which I call it. Like, and everyone's like, yeah, that's your course. And I'm like, okay, no, that's like a geology course. We literally lick rocks and like pour some like hydrochloric acid on it. Like, that's the course. This is not like a mining course. It's not showing you what it's going to be like. Because I get so many first years being like, is this what mining is? And I'm like, no, that's rock licking. Like, we don't do that again after that. The things that are applicable to mineral engineering is pretty much every course, because as engineering, I think all engineering disciplines, just the first 2 years, it comes back to haunt you no matter what. The specific to mining, I'd say fluid mechanics is a lot, and solid mechanics gets really big, because solid mechanics leads into rock mechanics in third year, and rock mechanics will become your life eventually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. So you still need that base.
You definitely need the base. If you don't have it, it's going to be tough, and you can like come back from it. By third year, you probably figured out you're studying that you can like make some work, you reteach yourself the stuff you missed along the way. But if you can, definitely learn it in second year when you should. Because a lot of us can skate through. I was a person who skated through, and then I turned around third year and thought, oh my god,
like that's a long time.
But
your third year was pretty far away from your second year.
Two and a half years away from it.
Okay, so you decided, what made you decide to look for PEY after second year?
So all of the people in our discipline kind of had a push to get a mining job as soon as you could, just because the industry was almost at an all-time low for like, so mining's really cyclical. So every like 10 to 20 or whatever years, it'll like go through a high where it's a mining boom and everyone's like, wow, mining's so cool. And then it goes through a huge low where like everyone's poor and like on the street. Like it gets real extreme real fast. And at that point we were at an all-time low. So all the people in my discipline were saying, if you can get a job, definitely do it. So just apply to everything that you can and see what comes up. And so I did that. Managed to get some interviews. I actually got two offers, and then two offers before Christmas, and then kind of went from there. And so I just had to like make it to the end to get back, like make it to the end of the semester, end of the year.
Got it. How'd you go about applying? Because I know I didn't know shit about applying to jobs in second year.
I didn't know either. So the PUI portal doesn't have a lot of mining postings, so we really related, we're going to our own discipline to try and get them to feed us postings, say, hey, at least look at these companies. So we have a list of, like, someone had a list of companies, and then they distributed it, and then we all, as second and third years and stuff, went to those company websites and just started, like, mass applying online. And that's pretty much the only way that a lot of us in downtown Toronto can get it. A lot of other schools, they just have connections because they're in mining areas and they can just talk to somebody. But from Toronto, it's a little bit more difficult. So online applying was my friend for that.
And you would actually get interviews from applying online.
Yeah, which is where all the resume workshops you get in university became really, really helpful. Because I look back at like my second and first year resume now and I like kind of cringe. But I could already see by second year it had gotten better. And so employers are aware of that. They're like, okay, this person's like 19 years old. They probably don't have like the resume of like a 35-year-old
person. They don't have like that. I like your CV, but also your tight resume. You don't have that.
Yeah, so they're pretty forgiving.
So would you say that like resumes in mining are decently similar to resumes elsewhere? Like the core principles still kind of hold?
I would say so. I think it's pretty similar. No matter what you're in, as long as you have a professional resume that shows like here are your skills, here's your experience, here's your school. Like it's pretty much the same.
Okay, got it. So you mentioned you like got a couple of offers. What made you decide that like, yeah, you know what, I'm going to take that break early and go?
I decided I kind of had enough of like studying. I think I was one of those kids who after high school, I probably should have taken like a gap year.
Sure.
And then, but I knew if I took a gap year, I'd probably never go to school. And so I was like, all right, I guess I got to go straight to university. And then I did. And then I was like, you know what, I'm kind of ready for a little bit of time off. I want to start working. And I didn't know if I was going to get a job because lots of people were graduating that time without jobs or ever having experience. Mm. And so I thought, okay, if I have an offer now, everybody I knew was like, you should probably take that. Because the deal was, I actually negotiated, which is kind of ballsy for like a 19-year-old. They wanted me to start in January, so like halfway through my second year. And I was like, okay, well, how about I start like with a... And they wanted me to do like a year term or... Yeah, I think it's a year term. And then I was like, okay, how about we do just a summer to start?
Yeah.
And so we did. I did a summer with them. It was good. They wanted me to come back, but also I wasn't sure about the company that time because the oil prices were dropping. It dropped like $40, which is big.
Like a barrel.
Yeah, $40. Yeah. It went from like $60 to like 29 or something. Okay. It was, or maybe it was 39. It got real low real quick. And then they were struggling. So I thought, you know what? I want a little bit more stability. I also want to like try something new. And then I got a call from a diamond mine and that's how I went up there. I got a call in August and like they did the medicals and all the criminal record checks every, like real fast.
Yeah.
That's also a thing in mining. I don't know if it's like that in any other discipline. You go through the full roundabout. So every time you get a job, you're getting a criminal record check. So you can't have anything on it. You get criminal record checks, you get full medicals, you get like screenings, it's like reference checks. So they'll call up everyone you know to see who you are for every company.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I've heard the only other industries I've heard of being like that are anything military and like aerospace. Like those are the two I've heard doing that. Certainly not anything I've been in. Nothing to do with, I mean, the closest I've been to aerospace is like airport design. And that's definitely still not like that at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess backtracking a little bit, this first posting was in oil. You were working on oil sands and whatnot. So what was that like? Like, where was that and what was the experience of working in that for the first time?
So I was actually based out of Calgary. So I moved to Calgary for the summer. There was Stampede. I met a whole bunch of great friends. There's a huge student community and we would like all of the oil company students, we somehow all had each other's emails and then we'd like go to a different bar every week and we just like had socials. We call them socials.
By email.
By email. There's like a calendar invite. There was like 400 people. It was great. And so we go to like a different bar every week. And then of course we all spent Stampede together. So that was fun. But as for my job, so it was in downtown Calgary. I was working for a project in Fort McMurray, well, north of Fort McMurray. But I was like kind of a satellite person, so I would like work from Calgary and then just everything would affect site. I did a supply chain, which actually isn't super engineering-y. It was mostly a business role and a business unit, but they thought they wanted some mining engineers because they're like, oh, well, maybe these people, well, engineering, they're smart. And then also from mining, this is a mine, so maybe they'll know something.
Like they won't just make like boneheaded business deals without understanding the reality of the physical things being moved.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then they also hired like 19-year-old students.
So, right. Like, so there's also that.
Yeah, so there's also that. Yeah. But I got really good at Excel.
Yeah.
So that was it was an interesting role. I liked it. But I didn't really want to do that for like a whole year, which is what they kind of wanted me to come back for. And sure. Plus, since the company's going through a transition period, they kind of need some time to figure out what they needed from their team. And so a lot of the times, not a lot of times, but there's times where I would just sit around and be like, I don't really have anything to do because like the project is still like figuring itself out, what's happening. So that was kind of a deterrent from staying there in oil a long time. And that wasn't just that company. That was a lot of companies at the time in oil having that problem.
Okay. Got it. And you mentioned that the diamond mine then just called you up.
Yeah.
Like, how's that happening?
Oh my God. So my boss, he called me at my desk, at the oil company, and I, like, he had my cell phone, and somehow he got a hold of my, I don't know if I gave it on the application, I'm not sure.
So this is a company you had applied to before?
I'd applied.
Okay, just like, for context, like, it wasn't just like, get me Romy's cell phone number.
Well, I'm pretty sure I must have applied. I don't remember applying.
Sure.
But I think I did, and he likes to talk on speakerphone, but like, he's, you know, in the Arctic, so the connection is awful. And like, sure. I was like, pressing the phone to my ear, being like, what? Who are you? What's going on? Couldn't figure it out. And then finally he got through and was like, talk to me, be like, diamond mine, you work here, interview at this time. And I was like, okay, I can do that. But even so, like, it was so hard to like figure out who he was or what was happening. All I knew is there was an interview for some company. And so I took this interview and I was like trying to piece through who this dude was and what bloody company. You know, like when you see those memes about people like, yeah, I took this girl like Starbucks on the first date because I forgot her name. Like that was me. I was having an interview trying to like ask questions to figure out.
Right. To pretend you knew everything. But being like, look, I know, but just between you and me, your name is.
Exactly. You're like, how do you spell your last name? He's like, Wilson. It's super simple.
Is that one L or two L's?
Yeah,
I've
exactly.
met both. Yeah, you got all the tactics.
Yeah. And then I took the interview, and then it went pretty fast. They did the medical and everything within like 2 weeks. And then, I was on like the next plane and then moved out of Calgary and then just didn't have a house anymore and lived out of a backpack for like 2 years.
Okay, so we'll unpack that, as it were. But so did you finish your term at the oil sands company?
Yeah, I finished.
Okay,
finished
then the you just went straight there.
Yeah.
So you weren't signed on to PUI technically at this point, were you?
Well, the oil company wanted me to do a PUI with them, and then I was like, no. And then for the diamond mine, I did agree to do a year-long contract from like end of August.
Okay.
But I negotiated that one a little bit too. I was like, so I want to go to Frosh Week. And then like, so I flew up to site for like 10 days and then like came back for Frosh Week and then went back to site purple. It was pretty ridiculous.
Wow. Okay. that warms my heart. I'm decently involved in that. So that negotiation, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But from the perspective of the PUI office, were you on PUI in air quotes?
Yes, I was on a PUI with them. At the time, it was under different management at the PUI office at U of T, and they were really not impressed with what I had done because I hadn't like called them beforehand and run it through them. And then, I don't know if you want to cut this part out, but like,
no, it's fine.
The man who ran the office at the time actually had a phone call with me and then insulted me and told me that the only reason I got any of my jobs was because I was female. So he told me that on the phone. Eyebrows are raised. And he told me a whole bunch of other stuff, just like put me down and like said I was like garbage and like shouldn't deserve this, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, wow, this is like some heavy hitting from like a 70-year-old man.
Yeah.
Who's supposed to be here to support me. Like your salary is to support me.
That's abuse is what that is.
Yeah. So I was considering like going to the department about it and just like making a big stink. But at that point I was like, you know, I don't want him to like screw me over later on. I don't know how long he's going to be at the PUI office. He'd been there for fucking forever.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I decided not to do anything about it at the time. I had my reasons. I don't remember them now. And then, so the PUI office was not impressed. And they were like, we're not going to approve it. And I was like, yes, you are. Like, I was like, this is not negotiable.
So why was it important that you get their approval at all? I mean, you had a contract with a company.
Yes. So I had the contract, which was completely outside of them. The company never even talked to my PUI office.
Well, exactly. It's between you and them.
Yeah. So that's another thing I find with the mineral program is that we're very detached from the university. We just go do our thing and then never come back. Or like, if we do come back, like there's very little communication. Whereas I've heard with some disciplines, like the PUI office, like will check in with the company. They have like relationships. It's an important thing.
Sure. But it's more in places with like really set internship programs and whatnot, right? Like they want to foster their relationship with like the big tech companies, for example, or like, cause it, that looks good.
Yes.
Does. Yeah. Yeah. Versus I think with mining, because it's so its own world, like it's, you're not going to like sell people on coming to the university on the basis of X mining company. Like it's not rarely the case.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
But
rare.
It's just like, oh, how many people at Google? Like that's a shiny toy to jingle.
Definitely.
Yeah. Something like that. But that said, why was it important that they approve something?
It was important because I wanted the credit for the work hours because I was already paying. I had to pay the PUI fees regardless. And so if they weren't going to credit me, I was going to be really upset because it was like $1,300. Like that's a lot of money.
It is a lot net. Yeah.
It's probably more now. And also if I didn't get the PUI, I had to deregister from school. And I was actually worried about my grades at the time because they always dangle that in front of you being like, you know, if your grades aren't up to snuff, there's not going to be room for you in your program when you come back. We're not going to accept you. And I was like, I don't have a 4.0. Like, I'm not getting back in. And then, so I was really worried about that. And then by my second year of PUI, I was just like, yeah, I don't care. Like, I had to, they would not approve, an extended PUI.
Okay.
And so I had to actually not be a student anymore. And so U of T didn't recognize me as a student. They took back all their stuff. And
so did you have to reapply?
I had to reapply. They wanted me originally to go through the entire process as if I was like 17 and in high school. Like there's like a video interview and all this other
stuff.
And I just went to my academic advisor. I was like, there's no way in hell I'm doing any of that.
So
she's like, okay, just fill out this form. It was like a one page form being like, hi, my name's Romy. Like I want to come back and then submitted it. And then it was fine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I found that happens a lot with U of T where it's kind of like a bluff to be called because like there's this initial front of just like raw bureaucracy and then you just go to talk to a human and you're like, hey, so could we not do this for my sake, for your sake, for the world's sake? And then it kind of works.
It's
just getting yourself into somebody's office. That is the issue.
That's not always the case. I know of some people who get shafted pretty hard.
Sure.
So you got to know your situation, who you're talking to.
I would like to point out shafted. Keep going.
Yeah, right? Like I say that all the time. I love it. So I think it's wise that the university kind of has these policies in place because otherwise they'd have 8,000 people trying to like have special needs.
Sure.
And it's like, well, that's not really, we don't have like the capacity to do that. But I also think it's important not to like terrify students into not doing what they want, what's best for them, just because of a bureaucratic thing.
Right, and it sounds like you were able to navigate around that pretty well.
Yeah. But I was like one of the first one. I think I was the first person that I know of to do it, and so they didn't know how to deal with me.
Sure.
And so I had to set a precedent, and that was difficult for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, certain trails blazed. I mean, I think I probably benefited from that in part. Like, I ended up doing an 8-month PY. And I know that was something where, like, that happened for me and for a lot of other people. They had to, like, drop out of school or defer or whatever the term is. But yeah, actually, I remember making a Facebook post about a bunch of people were like asking me how that works. And then yourself and I think Elizabeth commented on there being like, yeah, by the way, you could do your own thing.
I remember that. Yes,
yeah. So the reason why you had to kind of do that little rigmarole was because you did an extended PUI. So you ended up staying at this like diamond company for like a good long while beyond a year. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that. But first, like what was the setup like for you working at this place?
What was the setup? That's a big question. Like I had to get myself to Edmonton every 2 weeks and then they picked me up in a 737 along with the whole crew. We flew out of a private airport on a private plane. It was like chartered. And then we went to site, which was a 2.5-hour 737 right away. It's far. And we'd land on like a gravel and ice runway and then we'd like shuffle off, get on a bus, drive like on, we're on an island too.
Yeah.
And then we'd like drive.
This is near the Arctic?
It's about 200 kilometers south of the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
So I think it's that in like 300 kilometers south of two or 300 kilometers somewhere between Yellowknife and like the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
It was far.
So 737 flight from Edmonton and then you land on a gravel runway, you get on a bus and then you keep going north?
Then you're actually on the island, and then it's like a 10-minute drive to like the mine building.
Okay. And that was once every 2 weeks?
Yeah, once every 2 weeks, and then at the end it's the same thing, just in reverse.
Okay.
So you live in camp. There's a camp kitchen. They clean your room for you. They make you dinner, breakfast. You pack your own lunch, but they also can make lunch for you too.
Wow.
Yeah. But you have to do your own laundry, whereas there's sites that they do your laundry for you, which I think is pretty nice. But I also, I can't cook for if my life depended on it, which is funny because your life does depend on cooking. Yeah. and so I specifically chose a job where I wouldn't have to do that.
That sounds like a perk.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, but like, it's like hard to navigate around in an interview. Instead of being like, hey, I can't cook, so being like, you know, I really prefer amenities.
Pretty much. That's like on my resume. I need this, please.
Yeah. I like that. There's something of a power move to putting your demands on your resume. Being like, here's what I offer. Here's what I need.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's very upfront. I like that. I think I'll put that on there.
Yeah, that's the next job.
I'll think about that. I'll fill up some nice space.
Yeah.
So that was the shift. What were you actually doing, like, on a day-to-day?
What was I actually doing? So I worked 12 hours a day, mandatory, and then often when I was in project engineering, I would work, like, 14 to 16.
Wow.
During busy times. And it's 14 days in a row. So every day you get up and you work 12 to 14 hours.
So it's not weekends? No,
your time off is, like, your 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
And that's the only time you get off. And so... I started at a crushing plant, which was like, we called it the backfill plant. What did it do? We had giant crushing machines that just like crushed rock into like sand. It was insane. So you take rock that was like 2 meters big or like a meter wide and then just crush it down to sand.
Why?
So we were building, what the job was is that we were building a perimeter dike, so a dam. But we call it a dike just for geotechnical terminology. And it's a rock fill dam. It's 2.2 kilometers long. It's a giant circle. So the way that diamonds are generally come about in that part of the world is they come up in kimberlite pipes. Kimberlite is this really black rock. We call it ore. Mm-hmm. And there's sometimes they're diamond bearing. There's thousands or millions or whatever of like kimberlite pipes all over the world. But like very few of them are diamond bearing. So if you find one's diamond bearing, it means there's little diamonds in it. And diamonds don't look shiny and nice. They look like garbage, and you probably wouldn't know it was a diamond, like a rough diamond, when you pull it out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look like anything. It has to go through an acid bath before it looks anything like a diamond. And so they grow, imagine like a carrot. Mm-hmm. That's what the pipe looks like on in like the earth, if you were to slice the earth in half. So there's like a carrot. And then we mine down that pipe, just kind of a circular motion until we get smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. And so our perimeter dike was a big circular dike in the lake. So our diamonds were under the lake, whereas other diamond mines up there were in on land, but ours were not. So they were in the lake. So we had to build these giant dikes to section off the water and then suction out the water, like pump it out, and then just start digging in this like no man's land pit. It was amazing.
Well, like a place where humans shouldn't be able to walk because it should be covered in water.
Yes, exactly. And now just imagine we just made a mine in the middle of a lake and you're like, how did you do this?
That's crazy. How do you start doing that? Like, I can visualize the completed structure of this like carrot looking like cone stuck in a lake and now you can get to the water.
Yes.
I get that. How do you start building that?
You start building that. So that's where my first job came in. So I was at like almost the very start, not almost the very start, but very early on in the project, I was one of the longest term people of the project by the end of my 2 years, because like it's a short project, but I was there for so long. So we started the crushing plant. We took all of our waste rock that we dug out of other pits, and then we crushed it down to make this rock fill material that we would put in a big haul truck, and then drive it out to this area, and then we'd dump it into the lake, and these big bulldozers, we call them dozers, would just push that material into the lake. And so if anyone has taken geotechnical engineering, we had a zoned dam. So there was like certain material in the center, and then just outside of the center, there's a different material. And then just outside of that, there's an even different material. Mm-hmm. And so it's just all these different materials, but you have to like push it in a very specific way so you don't mix the materials, because it needs to go in sequentially at the same width, at the same everything, which is actually pretty hard to do in real life. Because if you ever like if you ever like play with sandcastles and you like knock over your sandcastle, like that stuff goes everywhere. Like there's no saving it. And so now you have to try and like construct something while making the sand go exactly where you want it to go every single time for 2.5 kilometers. So it was just me and like this dozer and like this fleet of trucks just like pushing this material, and I'm just like standing out on the end of this dike just like walking next to a dozer and like a truck. And these things, to give you the size, the scale of this, like they're bigger than your house. Like we're sitting in Gerstein Library, like that's Yeah. That's like a size of like a shovel at our mine. A shovel is just like a really big excavator.
That's crazy. It sounds like everything's just scaled up to gigantic proportions.
Yeah, it's like 10 stories high. Like, they're huge. I've seen shovels like almost the size of a band. They're unbelievable. It's like an entire workout just to like climb up to the top of that thing to like get in the cab to operate it. It's huge.
Were you operating them?
I never operated. They don't let students operate. There's also a lot of time and training, but it was at a different mine that you get like the really big equipment that I saw when I was in Arizona. Back to this diamond mine. So I was at this plant and we were just running the crushing material. So I was doing like the size fraction analysis and just being like pretty much a lab tech. So I spent like 8 months there because they asked me like 4 or 5 months in to extend by an extra year. So I'd have like a 2-year contract. And I was like, okay, I thought about it and then I did it. Because the industry...
What went into that decision?
So it was embankment coordinator, which is essentially like a field supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
I like to amp it up. It sounds really cool when I say that.
Yeah.
And so I would go out there and I would just like do the morning lineups. I would like have these trucks and be like, okay, you go here for this material and you go here for that. Come at this time. And I'd have like, I'd watch the dozer and be like, okay, you need to push like this, which is kind of weird when you're like 20 years old and telling like 50-year-old men how to do their job.
Yeah.
Nobody likes that.
Sure.
So you had to be really careful about the way that you talk to them, how they would take things. It became like kind of a PR thing. Like if someone's having a bad day, you had to like talk to them differently to get them to do the job.
Sure.
So it came like really psychological really quickly, because while you're trying to do a very technical job of this is the specification you need to build to this, people are, you know, human. They're not always going to do it like perfectly every time. So when they don't do it perfectly, how do you have that talk with them?
Sure. Especially as somebody who looks much junior to them.
Is much junior and is also female. That actually came up because there just weren't any women on site. And so
there
were very, very few. So to give you, an idea, mining on the whole is about 17% female.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in every, that includes female operators, engineering, like technical services, everything.
Sure.
So there's not a lot of women. And then it was just a very different dynamic to like, for these operators to have me there, to be anywhere near their crew, let alone being telling them like what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if they didn't tell me, if I didn't tell them what to do, and then the engineer of record came by, they'd be like, this is not happening. I'm not approving any of this section. You have to rip it out. And like, luckily that didn't happen, but it was always the threat. So you had to do your job properly.
Right.
And I mean, the biggest thing,
because it sounds so delicate.
It's delicate. But also the thing is that, you know, if you make a machine and it malfunctions, like, okay, maybe it'll like blow a gasket, it'll do something bad. If we make a mistake on this scale, there's people in the pit, there's people in this area, so you will kill hundreds of people if
right.
you don't do your job.
So this is that like real engineering stuff that they actually talk to you about.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the time when we hear that, I mean, like I'm an industrial engineer, right? Like, I mean, there's some things you work on that are really important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give the example of like airplane cockpits or whatever.
Yeah.
But like at the end of the day, usually I'm working on an interface where like, oh, like I guess they're just going to take longer to learn how to use their technology,
yeah.
right? Whereas in your case, it's like, nope, this is people. This is people's lives.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if you do your job wrong, you will kill someone.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a lot to have on your shoulders, particularly as a junior.
Yeah, how'd you deal with that?
I did fine with that. Like, I took it seriously. Always did my job, like, to the best of my ability, and everything turned out great. Like, the project is full steam ahead now. I mean, it's not just me. There's hundreds of people working on this.
Of course.
And everybody did a great job. So, obviously, the whole project's still standing, and it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, later on, I did do some project engineering where we had to do instrumentation monitoring. Because this is going to sound very scary, but it's not really, where we put some instruments in the ground and then we were measuring for like dike movement and like if there's too much vibration from drilling. This sounds very confusing. So
no, go for it.
We put instruments in the ground called piezometers. These piezometers were measuring the water levels within the dike. And the problem was is that we were doing other work on the dike with drilling. And so we drill into the dike, but if we were... disturbing the dike too much, that could have stability issues for the whole section
mm-hmm.
or that whole area. And we were in a very deep part of the dike. It's like 20 or 30 meters or something, which is big where because we're building in a lake. And it was sitting on a tiny little bit of what's called schmoo, which sounds hilarious.
That's amazing.
S-H-M-O-O. And it's great. And imagine, you know, when you go walking through the mud and there's a very thin layer of mud on your path, and you you can feel your heel hitting the bottom, but you know if you didn't quite hit it right, you're gonna slip out
immediately.
Yeah, or stepping on black ice. It's a very thin layer of black ice. That's what this is. And so we went and we dredged the bottom of the lake and took out all the schmoo that we could, but there was a very thin inch layer on it. But that inch is enough to complicate the entire dike.
Friction a whole lot.
Exactly. And so you have all these millions of pounds of material sitting on, millions of tons actually, of material sitting on this. And if that thing slides out, that's a $350 million project, going into the lake, and that's the end of it, plus people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so when we put in this instrumentation monitoring, if those alarms went off, it was a heightened alert, and we had to stop everything, evacuate the dike. Guys went running when these alarms went off, literally running a kilometer away.
Yeah.
They weren't even getting in vehicles, some of them. They just started running.
Yeah.
It was a big deal. So, but it's annoying because you're sitting there and you're I didn't have to do it because I was more senior at that point, but we had other people doing this job where we didn't have an automatic system enough that would just trigger an alert, so you'd have to watch the alert, and then if it went red, you'd have to call the guys on the dike. And this was a 24-hour position while they were in
so this is a full vigilance position.
Yeah. And so that was a whole big deal because you gave them the whole big scare. It'd be like, hey, have you seen all of these dams fail around the world and they kill so many people? Yeah. And that's you. Make sure that this doesn't happen.
This is that standard scare, the Con Hall waving bridge
scare.
But now it's your job.
Yeah. And it's so mundane for most of it, but on that one, it only takes a split second for you to not catch it, and something happens.
Wow.
And it's that quick. And of course, we never had any issues. We were very, very careful. The dike was built very well. But mm-hmm. there's stuff like that in it. Or, if someone makes a wrong turn in a haul truck, for some reason, the haul truck, if everyone knows what a haul truck is, it's a really big dump truck.
Mm-hmm.
And so the back of the bucket, so the thing that tips up and lets go of all the material, when the very end edge by the back tires, that's at the perfect height of the cab of another haul truck.
Okay.
So if someone, I'm not going to say that this happened, but if someone were to back in accidentally, not looking at their mirrors, they could back into another haul truck and decapitate the other driver.
Wow.
Which has happened at other sites. Mm-hmm. We had a close call. But I don't know why, if anyone's a mechanical engineer, why did you design it like that? Safety, literally head height.
That sounds like the kind of thing where you only realize that you messed up when you see it.
Yeah.
Right? Because mm-hmm. I don't think you think you just see your one haul truck and you're like, yes, this is well designed, this is ergonomic, this makes sense. And then you see when you put two of them beside each other with people, and when you see it, you're like, oh no.
Yeah, because I balanced the whole thing perfectly. This is the most optimized everything.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wow, you can decapitate another driver very easily.
Right.
And it happens.
Wow.
So that's something that's very worrying. We're in a very small area. It's 30 meters or less. A little bit more.
Which is small at the scale of trucks.
It's huge. These things have a 20-meter turn radius.
Yeah.
There's no room for two plus a big dozer in
there. It's like 5-point turns type deal.
Oh,
it's
actually the biggest pain in the world. So yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff.
How did you manage the psychological aspect of the job you were talking about before? What adjustments did you find you had to make when you got into a position of authority?
You always have to be aware of how you're talking to the crew, just professionalism, because mm-hmm. it's easy when you're up in the middle of nowhere with some people in close quarters, you can become very casual very quickly. You're just like, hey, buddy, just the way that you talk and your demeanor, it's just very friendly. But as a position of authority or even as an engineer, you have to be aware of how you talk to people just because... at the end of the day, sometimes you write reports on them, you do other stuff, so you want to make sure there's still that they understand that you're in a position of authority and that they're not, it's not just, oh yeah, Romy's going to let me off, it's fine.
Right, you're not just their buddy, you're also their supervisor.
Yeah, exactly. And so I wasn't their supervisor. They did have an actual supervisor because they were a haul crew on loan to my project.
Sure.
And so, but I would have to relay certain things or if there were certain issues or... all of that kind of stuff. And there are huge forms and processes to get somebody in trouble, which nobody ever wants to do, but it's a formalized process. But how do you deal with that? You just have to be aware of what you say. And as much as you want to have friends at site, you have to kind of have a bit of a barrier and it'll get pretty lonely. So the other engineers are generally your better friends because you're on the same level and you can just hang out. Whereas you and an operator, it's definitely different.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing night shift, that gets really lonely. if you're an introvert, I think it's really good. There's a lot of introverted people in mining because they just sit in their equipment by themselves for hours on end, and they enjoy that. They have the music, they just do their thing, and then that's great. Whereas if you're an extrovert and you get recharged by like having people around.
An extrovert like you.
Yeah. I'm a bit more of an extrovert. So then to have like literally go 6 hours without saying anything and sitting by myself, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to go insane.
Keep going nuts. Yeah.
Yeah.
How'd you end up dealing with that?
I just made sure I would talk to people enough during the day that I would like be like, okay, I'm okay with this. This is like baseline, like minimum of what I need, but I at least got that. And then if I didn't get that, just like technology is a beautiful thing. So I'd like text people back home. So I definitely like talked to a lot of people while I was up there.
Sure.
Yeah.
You got better with social media and whatnot.
Yeah, stay sane. They did allow Facebook in the common areas, like, because you have to use the mine's Wi-Fi, so you can't download anything. They block YouTube, they block a whole bunch of stuff just because it's a huge load on the system. If everybody's watching YouTube videos like gaming, like that would be, no one gets Wi-Fi then.
Sure.
But you could have Facebook, so you could at least talk to people.
So even when you're in those like 6 hour kind of alone sessions?
Oh no, actually that, no. When you're on site, no phones.
When you're on site, no phones. Wow.
Yeah. So like if you're not in your room or in like the kitchen or something, you can't have your phone on you. And so yeah, at that point, then it's just lonely. And then you just, but at that mine, I was doing so much work all the time. I wouldn't have had time to talk to people while on shift. Because while you're on shift, especially in that project, because your project mode, you're just going. So if I'm working 14-hour days, I'm not going to be sitting there like talking to like my ex-boyfriend or something like that. Well, he is my boyfriend.
Yeah. But that being very different from the way we usually talk about work-life balance or the way we talk about anything like that. Like, what did you have to do to make that adjustment, just like as a person, to be able to work 14-hour days for 14 days on end?
Just really incredibly motivated to be like, yes, this is what I want to do. There's, I don't know how much adjusting you can do. You just kind of accept your situation and just like live with it.
It feels like one of those things where like you have to rise to the occasion because you really don't have anything else.
Yeah, like you chose this.
Uh-huh.
So do it.
Right. What was your time off like?
Ooh, time off. So I gave up my house in Calgary and then I just lived in a backpack for a long time. So I'd go... I literally had a backpack with clothes in it and I'd just like go traveling.
Yeah.
And I'd go back to my parents to like refresh clothes and stuff like that. And so I went to a lot of different countries. Eventually I did kind of move in with, in the second part of my work term, I did move in with my boyfriend at the time. So on my off rotations, we would like spend our time together. But even then, we both of us were like mostly traveling.
Sure.
So it was just traveling all the time for like pretty much 2 solid years. I went to a lot of places.
Where'd you go?
I went to Colombia. I went to Israel and Jordan and Romania and like the Netherlands and stuff like that. And where did I go? Nicaragua, or was that recently? I think I went to Nicaragua.
Uh-huh. I mean, you went to enough places that you're trying to figure out when you went where.
Yeah, and then I traveled like the States a lot. So I went to like New York and Chicago and all these like fun Miami and all these places. So.
Which is cool because when you have a like 2 week breaks, you can do that. Like you fully can. Yeah. Did you ever take like 2 week breaks to just rest?
Yeah, definitely. Because traveling gets old pretty fast.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah. So I definitely took some time off to just rest and just sleep at home, particularly coming off of night shift. Because every rotation you do, a rotation of days, and the next one you come in, you do nights, and the next one you do days, and then nights. And so coming off a night shift, I would sleep for like 3 days until I was like ready to come back. Because you just worked 14 days of nights. So it takes a lot to transition back from that.
Right. Yeah. Just the circadian rhythm and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's quite a bit. So you were there for what, 2.5 years?
I was there for 2 years, but I spent like another half year in the oil sands doing that.
Oh, that was like at the beginning?
Yeah, at the beginning.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
What was coming back to school like?
It was weird because my classmates were in high school when I left for PUI.
Sure.
They hadn't even entered university. And so I met all these people and I was like, yo, I like remember, because like, when I started my contract, I negotiated to go to Frosh Week. And so I met like a couple of them for like...
Like you went to Frosh Week in the middle?
I went to Frosh Week, in like 2015.
Uh-huh.
And so when I came back in like 2017, like there were third years who I met like when they were like 18 and just starting school.
Sure.
And I was like, hey, how you doing? I'm in your class now.
How do you do, fellow kids?
Yeah. Like one of them was one of my classmates. I was his mentor in first year.
Sure.
I was a terrible mentor because I was never around. I'm so sorry if you're listening to this. We talk. So you miss a lot of stuff when you're on rotation too. You miss birthdays, you miss Christmas, you miss like holidays.
Of course.
So But coming back to school was pretty wild. Luckily, I had a really great class, so I fit in really well. But having to submit work that didn't mean anything was weird.
Right, because you know exactly why you're doing all the stuff on site.
Yeah, and you know, the things that I would do, they either would make the company money or detract money, or it would create a safety standard or whatever it was. It was very, very meaningful work, pretty much everything. And I knew why I was doing it and it had an impact. Whereas when I come back to school, someone's like, write me an essay. And I'm like, why the fuck does anybody care about this essay? And then they'd give me like this arbitrary grade. I'm like, what is this supposed to mean to me?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
No one's life has changed by me writing this essay.
Uh-huh.
And so I felt like very demoralized because I was like, why am I doing all of this work that I don't care about? The professor sure as hell doesn't care about and no one in the world cares about.
Like, right. And it was just like at the end of it, I get a piece of paper that says I can do work that I've already done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was very confused for a while. I was like, why am I here? Uh-huh. So then I remembered, yeah, I need to get a PhD at some point. So that's important.
To be able to just keep doing the kind of work you were doing.
Yeah. You got to finish your degree.
You
need that.
And they were just like, engineer. Yeah. Okay. Got it. So did you look for other work like before the end of your degree, or were you just like, honestly, let's just finish it up? How'd you go about?
So after third year, I did go and work. I went to the United States. Which for mining is a big thing. I know like a lot of Google people and Amazon people like from U of T, they all go to the States and like it's very common and I think that's super cool. But like in the mineral program, like nobody leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're already an international and like they go back to like Africa or something.
Sure.
But for me, I went down to Arizona and had like the time of my life.
Yeah.
I was like 4 hours from everything, which kind of sucked because I'm like, oh, I can't even like go to Phoenix. Like it's like
4 hours drive?
Yeah. And you can only drive. There's no airports.
Oh, okay.
So you have to drive or like you're walking for weeks. So, and it's desert. So there's nothing around. But the mine was super cool. It was like kind of in the mountains. And there was a huge intern group there. And then they put us all in dorm style housing. So it just turned into a giant frat house for 4 months.
I was going to say, that sounds like a recipe for that.
Yeah. It was like 30, like 20 year olds. It was wild. And then, like, but they're in everything. Some people were in accounting, some people in health and safety, a lot of people in engineering. Most of them were chemical or hydrometallurgical engineers, hydrometallurgical engineers, and then a few mining engineers. And then me, I was the only tailings person.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a really good summer. It was cool working at the mine. It was very different from my previous experience. So a different pace, different types of projects, different people.
Was it much more 40 hours a week?
Yeah. So I worked like 8 or 9 hours a day, and that was it. And then I'd just like go home and like, I don't know.
Be a person.
Just like go to the gym. It was good. So it was super fun. But I did very different work, but it was also very meaningful. And that's what I like about engineering.
Like
when you work, you like do stuff. And it makes
when you mean meaningful, you mean like you see the impact of what you did.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's what I like about my discipline is that I actually visually get to see it.
Right.
Like when I build a dam, like there's a dam there now.
Yeah,
and it's like, that's kind of cool. Whereas maybe if you code, you don't always see it because it's like very back end stuff.
I remember seeing a huge difference between that, between working in consulting and then working on roller coasters. Because it was cool. But basically, I remember like early on, it's like, I know I'm solving problems to the tunes of like millions of dollars, but it's just like, oh, like the stuff was stuck in invoices and now it's not. It's like, if you, like, we could literally say, we've made you $100 million. And then they'd be like, oh, okay, I guess it's going to take us 2 weeks to figure out whether or not that's true. Whereas with roller coasters, it's like, no, look, the line's moving 30% faster. No, like, look at it. It's right there. And like that, that was kind of the first time I saw something like as tangible as that. Because like every other time it was just digital design also.
Yeah.
Well, you see the pictures on the screen, but it's a debate about whether or not that's real, in air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
But like with yours, and when it's something like physical, you're like, yep, that wall in the lake didn't used to be there and now it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like a lot of people who go into engineering are kind of after that because we're all like, we want to like see our designs, want to see what happens with it because a lot of engineering is about that. Like, there's now a thing and it does stuff and you're like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, working in Arizona was super fun. So again, that was traveling. We even like went to Mexico for a weekend. We like went to other places.
Made some friends.
Yeah. Made some really great friends. I still talk to them to this day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, and then you came back for fourth year.
Yes, came back for fourth year, got wrecked by Capstone, and here I am.
Are you done Capstone?
No. So I it's like 8 months long. I submitted like my individual draft for my sections of Capstone like yesterday at midnight.
Congratulations.
And thank you. Yeah. I also submitted two memes with it, and my professor sent back like, I he's like, are there bonus points for memes in like the U of T policy?
And you should
like,
say yes.
I'm gonna say yes. Like,
see how far you can take that.
So in my email is like, hi Dave, like please see the attached. And like the attached was obviously my sections, but then also the attached was like a series of memes. And I was like, yes, which attached?
Signed, Rome meme done. And then just done. Just send that one off.
Yeah. Hashtag done.
Hashtag done. Do you, how often do you use that?
That's use it all the time.
You should, I mean, any office you run for, or anything like that, you're like, gets it done, like that's it.
Exactly.
I mean, that's maybe the best last name.
Yes.
Like, yeah. No, you're really lucking out with that one.
I think it's pretty cool.
What are you thinking for after school?
So I actually got signed really early. I got signed in October to go down to the Amazon in South America in a small country called Suriname. It's just above Brazil.
Wow.
And there's a gold mine in the jungle. And I'm going down there to be drill and blast engineering, which is... for anyone who's not in mining, it's essentially explosives engineering.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That's super cool.
Yeah.
Are you excited about that?
Very excited. It's going to be a whole different world. Like, they speak Dutch. They do not speak...
So it's a Dutch company.
It was a Dutch colony, which it got its independence a few years ago. But they have, like, 12 official languages because they're super multicultural. So they have, like, Indian there. They have Chinese people. They have... you know, like African people, they have other South Americans, me, I'm in there. So like their first language is like Dutch. And then their second language, I'm going to butcher this. It's like Sorong Tonga, which is like the local dialect of like Dutch and like a mix of all of like Mandarin and Hindu and all this stuff. And I'm really excited about that. I hope I pick up some cool words, but they operate in English.
Yeah.
But all the expats for this mine, they're all from like Montreal.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to be like the non-French expat. I'm going to, damn. So I'm going to learn French too. We'll see how it goes.
Sounds like a cultural experience with explosives in the Amazon. Like there's the headline.
Pretty much.
That's really cool. So you haven't been like, you've been like good, not searching for jobs, just kind of like taking your fourth year as it goes.
Yeah. I got lucky with that. A lot of my friends are still looking for jobs just because, you know, it's still, the industry is not what it should be, but like people are slowly coming up with jobs.
Nice.
Still a lot of online applications. Some people just got flown out to like BC to do some interviews, things like that.
Cool.
So it's looking good. And I'm excited for mine. I just got my second round of vaccines today, so my arm hurts. I have to take like malaria pills and everything to go down there.
You were mentioning that like the mining industry is pretty strict with its medicals and its background checks and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that goes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What have you gotten involved with, like outside of kind of, I guess, like mining, or outside of like working in mining, like over the course of 4 years?
So in my first like 2 years, I was really, really involved in just like a whole bunch of stuff. So I did like a little bit of Engineers Without Borders. I did like a little bit of iLead. I did Your Next Career Network for a little bit too.
Sure.
And then Concrete Toboggan was a favorite of mine.
Sure.
Yeah. So I did the Concrete Toboggan team. That was good. And we also had like a little mining competition. So I actually organized like a little mining competition through, I think it was through EWB in second year.
Mm-hmm.
I did another mining competition first year. And then when I came... back after third year, I went to Saskatoon for a mining competition. We do mining games every year, which I don't know if anyone ever knows about this, but it's like we take 16 MIN students and then we go to a different city in Canada every year. So this year it was in Edmonton. Yeah, last year it was in Kingston. Next year it's in Halifax. It's in Halifax next year. So we go there. All the mining schools across Canada send a team. And we just have like 4 days of games. And so like engineering games. So it was like pretty much a bunch of your courses that you take in engineering. For mining engineering, there's a competition on it, and so they give you a thing that you have to solve, and like whatever team solves it the best wins. And then there's other stuff like equipment operation. There's like jackleg drilling, which is like a 150-pound drill. You have to like.
What proportion, like actual competition and dankness, is it?
It's a solid like 50-50.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Which is like a good place.
Yeah. So like you pretty much don't sleep ever. Mm-hmm. We don't like want to talk about it like too much because we're worried people might start shutting down.
Yeah.
If anyone knows what concrete toboggan is,
kind of
imagine
like
concrete toboggan, only you have like actual competitions that you have to use your brain every day for like a solid 8 hours. And then you have all the shenanigans of concrete toboggan in the evenings.
So, like, eventually, like, you've got, like, a sun-dried brain, like, still, like, going at it.
Yeah, like, it's, like, 6 a.m. and you're getting ready to go to your event, and you're like, I can't see, I don't know my name, I don't know what's happening. Like,
but drill.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I went to the kind of indie version of this for the first time, like, earlier this semester.
Oh, yeah?
Kind of, well, because, like, having done consulting, we're just like, hey, consulting team, let's do it, right?
Yeah.
And we get our case, and, you know, like, we kind of solve the case. It's a 3-hour deal, so, like, you don't have to prepare that much in advance. You just, like, do it. Like, you get the case, 3 hours. And my main focus, apart from, you know, making the case happen, was to see how we can, like, pass stupid acronyms and puns into our presentation.
Oh my God.
Like, that was the big deal. So we ended up, the moniker for the solution ended up being, like, puff, puff, pass the spliff. And that was the, and I was like, I don't smoke, but that was, like, the whole thing. And it was like part unique field, as in puff, and then, like, spliff was something like selected parts limited information field, like something like that.
God.
It was like full bullshit. But and the solution was fine.
Yeah.
But it was so that's like when you toe the line where you're just like, no, the solution's still good, but, like, let me tell you, like, we're gonna have some fun with this.
That's so funny. Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Well, so we were actually talking about this before, and I think an important topic to get to before the end of this interview is puns in mining.
Yeah.
You mentioned that there's a lot of opportunity, but the execution is severely lacking.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. So I use words like shafted, you gotta, like, rock this, or, like, you know, we're really underground with this method, but no one ever understands them, and no one thinks they're funny, and it's just me, so I just, like, cackle to myself in the back, and then no one else laughs. You're laughing, so thank you.
I mean, I'm a big fan of puns, but it's funny, it's hard for me to tell whether or not, like, I say something, and you're like, ha ha, it's been 5 years of this, or like, oh no, this is actually something that isn't said, because I always wonder, right? Like, I'm not around this. Yeah.
Well, the mining ones, specific to, like, mining terminology, like, no one ever uses them. So if you use it, I think it's hilarious. But the rock ones, like geology, because it's easy for everyone to know, like, what the rock nice is, like G-N-I-S-S.
Yeah.
So, but it sounds like the word nice. And so people are like, this is really nice. And then, like, spell like a rock, or, you know, don't take this for granted. And you're like, oh.
So do people do that? Or?
If you talk to a geologist, they might, but they also roll their eyes a lot.
Uh-huh.
But I like to say those things to non-mining people. So I'll make mining, like, those kinds of jokes to non-mining people.
Uh-huh.
And then I realize that their geology is very limited after, like, 3 rocks.
Yeah.
And then I'm, like, going on a whole tangent.
Yeah. Nice spelled with a G is certainly niche.
Like,
That's out there. But I think, like, rock, shafted, underground, like all of that, like, you know, like digging for dirt, like anything like that is certainly par for the course, and, like, I fully support your efforts.
Thank you.
I feel like that it's also in a weird, very groanful way, a way to make something accessible, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where you're just like, instead of like, oh yes, I'm a mineral engineer, being like, nah, you still have fun with what you do.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
There is something there. What, like, looking back over the last 5 years, what would you change, if anything? Like, what would you do differently?
What would I do differently? I probably would have reached out a bit more in first year for, like, study tips, and, like, figuring out how to be a student, because definitely a very stubborn person who's like, now I'll make it through, it'll be fine. Right. And then, like, I did, but I think just, like, finding, like, a study group to do stuff with, and then also maybe go to more, like, information sessions on, like, how to be a student would be useful. I hear in first year they now have a class on how to be a student. Like,
yep.
Yeah.
Taught by students, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We have a couple mins who do it. And I think, like, that's really useful. And I would probably change, the outreach side of that. And just, like, dealing better with stress. And I think that's a very common student thing. Like, we're all very stressed here.
Sure.
And, yeah, in first year, there was, like, 3 different times where I was like, that's it. Like, I'm done.
I'm not doing
this anymore.
I'm not moving. Like.
Yeah, and then in second year, it wasn't even a case of, like, dropping out. It was just a case of, how have they not kicked me out yet? Like,
sure.
I was just like, how far can I push this?
In terms of, like, grades or in terms of, like...
Grades.
Conduct.
Definitely some conduct. Yeah, I had some issues with that.
Yeah.
But in general, like... I feel like I could have had a more enjoyable experience if, like, there was just more support. I know that's a big thing in U of T right now, and
sure.
I think that's a lot, that's very important, because I struggle with that, and I know a lot of, like, very successful people, like some of my good friends who were, you know, working at Google and, like, killing it at this place and this place, and, like, it was, they had some major, major issues.
It was, like, hairy getting there.
Sorry?
It was, like, very hairy getting there.
Yeah, exactly, and so we were all kind of in the same boat, and I think we all just reached out to a place that we knew that facilitated that kind of stuff, it would have been a bit smoother. So that's what I would have changed. I think I would have had a more enjoyable 2 years academically if I'd dealt with stress a lot better.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess on the point of reaching out, if anybody like resonates with what they've heard here and they like want to reach out to you, ask a question, something like that, where should they find you?
So they can find me on Facebook pretty easily. My name is like literally the only one, except for like this boy in Thailand who somehow has like Don't Roam Me. Like it's just like switched.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm the only one on Facebook, so feel free to reach out to me. Also, I've seen me in person. I go to the pit and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much the easiest places.
Sweet. Yeah. Makes sense. All right. Romy, thank you for being on.
Yeah.
I think this might be the last episode that we have a guest on. Mm-hmm. So thank you for wrapping it up beautifully.
Yeah.
This has been That Thing I Did for a Year. We'll see you when we see you.
Thanks.